against Corey and Murphy, Mr. Elfenbein and Mr. Miller. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
That'll be fine, and you can proceed when you're ready.
This case concerns Mrs. Murphy's intentionally quitting a higher-paying job for a lower-paying job so that she could position herself to file a few months later for primary custody of the party's two sons. The issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion by failing to impute income to Ms. Murphy. Whether to impute income is within the sound discretion of the court. And as stated in Hughley, the issue is whether or not is that the decision will not be disturbed as long as it stays within the court's range of choices, and that that is not influenced by a mistake of law.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. What we said in Broadhead, that in addition to proving a material change in circumstances, which I'm not sure anybody seriously contests here, the petitioner also has to prove that the material change actually warrants a modification. And as you just indicated, the court here, while it didn't offer an explanation, the result is that the child support calculation is still within the presumptive guidelines. And by statute, the court's not required to offer an explanation. So where does that leave us in terms of any error by the trial court?
Well, the fact that they're not required to explain why they didn't impute does not inherently mean that a court cannot that a court can't err in refusing to impute. With Hughley.
That's what we said in Prizia versus Prizia, isn't it?
Well,
in Prizia we said that the court followed the statutory guideline and was therefore not required to make any findings regarding whether that amount was unjust or inappropriate. That's exactly what happened here, isn't it?
Well, except that if there is a circumstance where, as in Nemec and in Broadhead and in Brody, they also their citations to the law that that a party may not seek to be underemployed. The parties cannot be underemployed.
Well, they can certainly be underemployed as long as they can support their children. You can take any job you want to as long as you can provide for the well-being of your children, can't you?
Well, certainly what would happen is that if you did that, then the court, though, should hold you to the income of the higher amount.
Well let me ask you about that, because given the 2006 amendment to 20-108.1.
Right.
If a trial court finds that a job change was a, quote, good faith and reasonable employment decision, doesn't that allow the trial court not to impute?
Yes, but I mean, if you look at the language,
Doesn't that in this case?
No, because, well, for one thing, if in looking at the clear language of that provision, where it says, and further, that any consideration of income imputed based on a change of parties' employment shall be evaluated with consideration of good faith and reasonableness of employment decisions made by the party, including to attend and complete an educational or vocational program likely to maintain or increase the party's earning potential, which is the language of statute. I think that's clear that what they're looking at is that it is a good faith decision in terms of the future finances of the family. An attorney who
would need to say limited to rather than including those circumstances for that to be the reading.
Well, it's not saying including but not limited to, it's saying including, and
which generally means there are other things as well.
Yeah, but I think it's also suggests that that's the that this these are the issues. This is the scope of the issues that they are looking at. But even more, the fact is that if this is interpreted to mean that a person desiring, as parents throughout the Commonwealth do desire to have primary custody of their kid, children, could leave a job that has long hours or weekend hours and go and take a lower paying job with better hours, and that that will not be result in imputed income, I think that the result is that the exception consumes the rule, and that basically that Brody and Nemec and they're holding that a party may not be underemployed simply vanishes.
So would it be your position that in and amongst the good faith reasons for taking perhaps a lower paying job, that what would be in the best interest of someone's child or children would not be a factor in that? For example,
well,
they're in a position to spend more time with their children or participate in their upbringing as opposed to working 80 hours a week?
Well, and there, again, you get into the area where the language that the personal preference of the parent is not paramount. And while certainly in the cases where the child has a particular need, where the child is of tender years, or the child had, there was a case where the child had severe disabilities, then that makes sense. But again, if it is simply going to be that the parent thinks that the child would be better with them, then any parent going into a lawyer's office and saying, "What can I do to get primary custody?" He goes, "Well, you can take a lower paying job."
Well, it seems to me, Mr. Judge Attlee's question goes to the basic statutory scheme here, which is, all things being equal, the legislature has, for reasons of their own, set up these guidelines, these child support guidelines, mm-hmm. and they are presumptive. They're not carved in stone, and certainly the court can deviate from them if there's a reason, either up or down. And the point is that they're presumptive, and if the court follows them, that's fine. That's what the law has concluded is the appropriate child support level, given that set of circumstances. However, if the court deviates from that, then it is required to give a reason, and that, whether it's up or down. Now, the question, though, it seems to me, is here, the court didn't give a reason. There was a change in circumstances, but the question is whether it was material to the welfare of the children. And given that the result is still within the presumptive guidelines, I guess the obvious question is, why do we need to impute income or do anything else if there's no change in child support warranted?
Well, because it has put her actions have put the family in financial harm. It is the father.
Well, that's Judge Attlee's point, though, is
yeah.
that the focus of child support is the welfare and of the children.
Right.
That's the only. We're not talking about spousal support or anything
else. No.
Child support, and the legislature has said under a certain set of circumstances, the law is that the children are well provided for under these presumptive guidelines. Now, if we're going to deviate from them, there better be a reason. And here we have a situation where there's been no there's been a deviation from the child support, no imputation of income, but we're still within the guidelines. So, in terms of the law, the presumption is the children are being well cared for. Why isn't that something we have to accept?
Well, because the the standing law, as I say, under Broadhead and under Nemec and under Brody, is that a party may not be voluntarily underemployed. And if we state that a party may not, that can't be raised, because you're always going to be able to make, the other side's always going to make the argument that the reason why they were voluntarily underemployed, or they cannot.
Well, how do you get around Prisia then? Where in Prisia we said, absent a mistake of law, when a circuit court follows the statutory guidelines in determining child support, this court will not and cannot disturb the circuit court's findings.
Well, but I believe Prisia dealt with other, that the facts are distinguishable, but that...
Well, I mean, the analysis is identical. In Prisia, the result was that the support ordered by the court without explanation was within the guidelines. Isn't that exactly what we have here?
Well, yes, but it's in violation of, but it is allowing her to be underemployed, which in turn is creating a...
If a person makes $500,000 a year,
yeah,
and accepts a lower paying job at $300,000 a year,
mm-hmm,
and the child support isn't changed because the children are still being well cared for at the level of $300,000 a year, why do we care as a court?
Well, of course, when you're dealing with the higher numbers,
example is hyperbole, but I mean the principle is identical, isn't it? I mean, I just don't see an analytical difference.
Well, except that it's put, well, A, it means that this is then a valid approach that anyone could take if they were that, like I say, it ends Nemec and Brody.
No, you've made a slippery slope argument that seems to assume something that I don't believe you can rightly assume, because the imputation statute requires the court to determine whether it was a good faith employment decision. What you're describing is somebody doing it just to get out of an obligation and using it as a tool in that way, and then a trial court would be free to say, I don't find that was a good faith employment decision.
But it is saying that if anybody wants to try to get primary custody of their kids and they're working at jobs that that require them to work weekends or long hours, that they can seek the lower-paying job even to the detriment of the financial well-being of the children.
Mr. Elvin, I just want to remind you, you're well into your rebuttal. You can keep on going if you want.
No, thank you, sir.
Ms. Miller.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael Miller. I represent Corey Murphy, the appellee in this case. And what distinguishes this case from a lot of others is that the parties, when they reached their agreement in July 2013, specifically reserved and recognized that the wife would be seeking a change of employment. Her working hours were onerous. They were extensive, interfered with the parenting relationship.
Well, let me stop you right there. In the abstract, I'm sure you would agree that an agreement such as that, if it negatively impacted on the children's welfare, would be something the court wouldn't have to implement.
If it was contrary to public policy or if it was
power. The parties can't agree among themselves to alter child support to the extent that it is not in the best interest of the children. And the court always has the ability to supervise
correct.
That.
So the court would have to make a finding that the parties' agreement, in this case, their agreement lays out where they chose to deviate from the guideline amount, and they made an arrangement where the mother paid the daycare directly. She also paid for the house because this was tied to the marital residence being sold. Once the marital residence sold, then there was a new financial arrangement. But they had discussed that she would be getting this new employment, and she succeeded in that. The 170 number that counsel for the father wants to use was never a matter that was subject to the agreement and was never part of the calculation. That only came up in the pendente lite hearing, and there's no evidence that the $170,000 to the mother was ever used in 2012 when the parties separated. or 2011 when the party separated, 2012 when the father filed his complaint, or in 2013 when they reached their agreement. And so we've got that unique feature here. Also, a lot of the cases that Father's Council cites are child support only cases, not done in conjunction with the change of custody. Legally speaking, child support differs from the other areas of family law. And for spousal support, we only have 107.1. Property division, we only have 107.3. Child support's got this split statute of 108.1 and .2. 108.1 says apply the guidelines in 8.2. 8.2 is kind of a one-way street, that if you go into the guideline determination, which the court did here, there's only one escape from 108.2, and the father doesn't explain or provide that escape. The escape is the court has to find that the guideline was unjust or inappropriate. The court didn't do that here. Pritzia says the court doesn't have to do that here. You know, the mother prevailed below. She's entitled to the presumptions in her favor. Presumption is the law was correctly applied. And so the judge did exactly what the statute provides. He looked at 108.1, says apply the guideline, determine the guideline, and was satisfied with that guideline amount. And even Brody, that's frequently cited by the father, says before imputing income to a party, the trial court must first determine the presumptive amount of child support under the guidelines, citing Farley versus Lipsky. So there is no imputation. As Father's suggesting, there's like a two-tiered imputation. We impute first for the guideline, see if we get an unjust or inappropriate result, and then the judge can come back for a second imputation under 108.1 to adjust that. But then that says, suggests to the judge, save yourself the effort of explaining why you're imputing and why you're deviating from the guideline amount. Just impute the full amount up front in doing the calculation, and then we don't have to worry about that. And it essentially allows a frustration of the legislative scheme here. Because, as Brody continues, if a trial court imputes income to a party, it must make written findings explaining why imputed income to the party would make it unjust or inappropriate to award the presumptive amount of child support, citing the Richardson case. So in this case, the judge followed the statutory scheme. He took the party's income as he found them, which is what the Brooks-Rogers case suggests is, take the parties as you find them, apply the number, and see if you get a result that's unjust or inappropriate. Here, the judge didn't feel that it was because he chose not to deviate from that. And so in this instance, the trial court acted within the statutory scheme. It fulfilled its obligations by determining the guideline amount. And in fact, there was a change of the custody visitation arrangement here. And so there were other things going on simply besides a pure modification. And so that's kind of where, you know, the courageous part of me says 108.2, we didn't find the unjust, just drop it at that. But it kind of came back, well, what about, you know, the father's argument that we need to come back to 108.1 and look at these factors and so forth. But I don't think the court on appeal is required to do that, to start looking behind what the judge could have done or should have done or anything else when he's fulfilled the statutory obligations there. So that's pretty much what I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Elfenbein?
Sir, may I follow up just briefly on your line of thinking and argument before you left the lectern last time? You had indicated that if we are to adopt the position in this case, that the court clearly could have found that there was a good faith reason for accepting a lower paying position, that the problem with that is then you've got everybody coming into their office to look for a way to justify a change in custody by accepting a lower paying position. Putting my previous position of having heard a number of these cases on the trial court bench, people in fact do that all the time. And doesn't it then become the discretion of the trial court in determining whether or not somebody does in fact have a good faith reason for seeking and or accepting a lower paying position versus one that's designed simply to find a way out of their financial obligation?
Well,
But that would allow them then to be voluntarily seeking to be unemployed, underemployed.
Well, the trial court can't stop somebody from seeking another position, whether it's to gain in salary or to reduce in salary. Right. The only thing the trial court can do is determine whether or not it's for a legitimate purpose, which could include being in the best interest of the child or to further their own education and ultimately employment opportunities down the road. I mean, that's a factual finding, is it not?
Yeah, that would be a factual finding. The argument I was trying to make was that it is best for the children if their income, and particularly in this case, if they could retain the income that they had originally, that the mother had originally.
Was there any evidence presented in this case that the $108,000 was not going to be sufficient to meet the needs of the children from a support?
Yes. Well, what the argument was I, in pendente litis, since it had been imputed to 179, that was what the father was receiving, and we asked the father if that was how that was working. He's saying if he got the check on time, he was able to get by.
So what's the evidence that there was going to be harm to the children?
Well, there was, that if the amount got reduced, then there would be problems getting by. And plus, there was the expense sheet.
Did he testify that there was going to be any harm that comes to the children, that there wouldn't be food on the table for them, they wouldn't be able to be educated or otherwise supported? Or was it just the evidence that he was getting by when he got the check?
Well, that and the expense sheet that was put in, which showed how much he was spending on...
But the expense sheet is not anywhere relevant to child support guidelines, correct?
No, I'm just saying it shows what expenses he was incurring on a monthly basis, and that it was using that 107 based on the support he was receiving.
But those are not factored into the child calculation of child support guidelines, correct? You're just looking at gross monthly income, any work-related daycare expenses.
Right. I was just saying, when you're asking how would the court be able to determine that there would be problems from the reduction, that if you asked if there was any evidence put in, and that and the prior question would be the two pieces of evidence.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Elfenbein.
Thanks.
All right, we'll come down to Greek Council.